welcome to the Leap Form Podcast, episode number 12. Today we have Ben Williamson. It's a little bit different today. Ben is a senior associate and general counsel with Invest Nebraska. Ben is also part owner of Nerve Health and Fitness in Omaha. So not only do we talk quite a bit about the process of venture capital, a little bit about entrepreneurship, but Ben's able to have a cohesive conversation around what Elite Form does as well. This was also the last podcast we recorded prior to the pandemic shutting everything down. So this was the last face-to-face in a while. Watch for Elite Form to do some Instagram Live efforts. There's, as you've already noticed, a lot of good content that's coming out of people just trying to keep in touch with each other. We'll probably join in with that party. We just may be a little bit more lighthearted about it. So without further ado, Ben Williamson.
So we're just going to talk.
Cool.
And we'll just see how it all goes.
Love it.
So you came strolling in and you have an enterprise legal studio, kind of Nike.
Quarter zip
on. They do a lot of our legal stuff. How do you know those guys?
Basically, so when I got into my current role, which we can dive deeper into, but it's really just working with startup companies, technology startup companies specifically, and then also doing some investing with startup companies. In the state of Nebraska, there's really one, and I don't mean this disparagingly to anyone else, but there's really one kind of one-stop shop for attorneys that work with startup companies. And the guy that founded the group, his name is Bart Dillashaw.
Shout out, Bart.
Shout out to Bart. He's a man, extremely smart. He would actually make a great podcast guest at some point. He used to work out in Silicon Valley, out on the West Coast for a number of years, moved back to Omaha. I think his wife's from around here, and now runs his firm called Enterprise Legal Studio. And this is certainly not an advertisement for them, but I guess me wearing their swag sort of is a walking advertisement. But so we work a ton with Bart. They represent lots of the companies that we work with and we invest in. So oftentimes we are, I guess you could say, adverse to Bart, as in he's on the other side of the table. But we also work together quite a bit, just kind of in the startup ecosystem is kind of the stereotypical catch-all phrase that people use. But in the startup ecosystem, we work together all the time, almost every day. So, and he gives me free stuff. So me working for a nonprofit, we have less swag than the for-profit legal studio. So
just to set the stage, and we'll come back to that, do you want to describe for folks what you do?
Yes, absolutely. So currently the day job is best described
Is there a night job?
Depends on the time.
Okay.
I feel like I always have things, weird things on the side.
So fair enough.
The gym is one thing, which I'm sure
we'll
talk
about.
Oh,
that's true. That's true. We'll get to that.
There's always something on the side, but the day job is basically, I say working with startups, the easiest way probably to describe it that most people are familiar with is venture capital, which effectively just means investing in startups. Now we can unpack that. There's a lot to that.
Well, let's keep it more simple first, right? So the name
yep.
of the entity is Invest Nebraska.
Invest Nebraska.
Right. Which consists of who?
So it consists basically of three full-time...
No one that's listening to this knows who you are.
Employees,
so we'll keep it basic.
So we can give us super quick. There's not much of an elevator pitch here. But yeah, Invest Nebraska, super progressive name there. But as many people that probably are listening to this could imagine, Nebraska has been way behind in terms of investment into startups and into innovation as compared to other states, specifically on both coasts. I think that's sort of common knowledge that most of the money with respect to startups and innovation goes to the coast. And so about 10 years ago, now Nebraska and its Department of Economic Development, which we shouldn't talk about because that's more of a boring topic, but that's just a state agency that worries about things like that, innovation, growth, retaining talent in the state or attracting talent from out of the state. And that can apply to talent in any career path, really. But they understood that we were way behind in all these things and we needed to incentivize that because ultimately incentivizing those things would create better companies, more better companies, move the state forward in a lot of different ways, whether we're talking about tax dollars, revenue creation, or just in terms of cool new companies, innovative companies starting here. And so what they did is created a program that set aside a couple $1 million on an annual basis to invest in these startups. But then there's also a bunch of programs that are for grants for these startups to help startups get going and build their first version of their technology or hire their first employees or whatever the case might be. And so sort of as a creature of that legislation or all of that activity in the state of Nebraska, Invest Nebraska started partnering with the state to administer that program. I feel like that's probably a boring way to put it. Really just take that money and work with startups, try to help startups get off the ground, and then ultimately invest in those startups to help them grow and scale and basically take their product out to the market. So obviously, Elite Form is a good example of a company that sort of was born out of this Nebraska ecosystem for innovation. So I don't know if that answered the question in a concise, direct way.
Well, we're not going to argue it was concise, but yeah, we're not going to worry about that.
Okay.
So what specifically though do you do?
So specifically, as I think I briefly mentioned, there's exactly three full-time employees in the office. And we have our CEO that sort of kind of handles the broad economic development goals. So helps manage and oversee some of the infrastructure programs in the state, manages the relationship with our board of directors, with the state themselves, manages the relationship with the university and the corporate side, and kind of all of that stuff that requires more maturity and responsibility. And he's fantastic at those things.
His name is
Dan Hoffman. Is his Shout name. Out Shout out Dan. To Dan. And then I sort of lead the investment team for the company. So I'm sort of on the front lines working with the startups, ultimately doing due diligence or kind of talking to the startups to decide if it's a good investment. And then post-investment, I'm typically the one that's either participating in board meetings or continuing to kind of manage that relationship over time. And then Matt Foley in our office, he's a program director for a couple different things. I mentioned infrastructure. What I mean by infrastructure is really different pieces in, again, I'm going to use that kind of stereotypical like startup ecosystem, pieces in the ecosystem that are really foundational and important for the growth and the startups themselves. So an example is that I think most people are familiar with is startup accelerators. So the typical model there is a company comes in with an idea on the back of a napkin. They go through this 90-day accelerator and they come out on the back end and they are somehow better off than they were when they came in.
What do you say somehow?
Theoretically, they should be better than when they came in. That's not always the case. And oftentimes you'll actually see startups come in that completely change their idea over the course of the accelerator. I think in most cases, they do come out better off. They are often an opportunity to interface with mentors in the community, investors. A lot of times it kind of brings together corporate involvement as well, which is potential client bases for some of these companies. And so in Nebraska, we have a couple of these accelerators. And then kind of another version of that infrastructure is what people call incubators, which maybe it's self-explanatory based on how it sounds, I guess, but it's really just subsidized office space where a bunch of different companies can be in the same space, kind of learn from each other. And then oftentimes there's programming or speakers or mentors or service providers that are brought in to kind of help provide guidance as well. And so this is sort of a long description for Matt, but so he kind of heads up Invest Nebraska's efforts into those areas. So we have an agriculture technology incubator on one of the campuses here in Nebraska. I think everyone listening to this understands that one of the things Nebraska does really well behind football and maybe that's it is
you're gonna argue they do football is agriculture.
Well, in my lifetime, we've done football well. Okay. It's becoming
on a long enough timeline.
A distant memory, but I think we're all optimistic. We're moving the right direction. We could talk for an hour about that probably.
I'm sure we could.
But so obviously we have this predisposition or maybe that's not the right word. Maybe just we have the tools in Nebraska to be good at agriculture. And so that's something we're trying to encourage innovation around agriculture. So he heads up that program. We have a similar incubator for biotech companies. So companies that are actually doing like bench lab work, which is way outside, I think, mine and your realm of expertise. So he kind of heads up those programs, and then he helps me with some of the due diligence working with companies as well. But that's kind of the full team.
So a lot of people are going to know the TV show Shark Tank.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So as you describe those three people, are you the Mark Cuban on Shark Tank? Are you the guy someone's pitching to?
Absolutely. Often identify with Mark Cuban. Sometimes
you identify with Mark Cuban?
Sometimes I feel more like Mr. Wonderful. It really depends on the company that I'm talking to, which mold I go into. But yeah, so effectively I'm the guy that hears the pitches. Actually, that's funny that you say that. That's how my wife describes my job to other people.
Cuban?
Just Shark Tank.
Just Shark Tank
stuff, which honestly gets us 75% of the way there, I think. So yeah, I appreciate the analogy.
So if I'm someone, I'll steal your phrasing. I'm someone who has an idea on the back of a napkin.
Yep.
I want to pitch to you. What do I need to do?
Tactically, so without going into way too much detail here, again, as I mentioned, the investor funding landscape, specifically in Nebraska, is still pretty immature, pretty limited. And why that's relevant is there's just not that many investors. So if there's a company that is ready to raise money, there are going to be a lot of people that either can introduce that company to me or just point you in the right direction. So I would say this is actually unique for our organization as compared to what a real venture capitalist or real venture capital firm maybe is like. Almost everything, and we can put this in terms of, you know, like company terminology, all of our customers, if you will, are inbound sales. So basically everyone comes to us through warm email introductions, or I bump into at the coffee shop, or it's an introduction from someone that we've already invested in. There's very little of it where we're reaching out and going in and trying to either recruit or sell to people that aren't in our network. So Nebraska is sort of a weird, close-knit, small network ecosystem. If you compare that to, again, going back to maybe firms and companies on the coast, I think it's very different. It's more of a sales process and trying to go out, find the companies that you're interested in, and then ultimately, just like any company, kind of show your value to them, because they have to pick you as an investor as much as you have to pick them as a company.
So I've done the networking.
Okay.
Right? I've managed to get half hour of coffee time with you.
I didn't bring my checkbook today, but so, all right, let's go down the road.
What do you want to see from that person? Like, what creates a good first conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I can talk specifically for me.
There's no one else here.
That's a very good point. For me, I like an informal initial conversation. I don't necessarily fit the mold here, going back to the Shark Tank analogy. I don't necessarily want to sit there and hear a full-blown detailed pitch about the company and why I should invest. It feels fake. It feels manufactured. And frankly, I don't know if this sounds arrogant or anything like that. I guess I don't care. For me, I think anyone can kind of put together a nice pitch
deck. Yeah.
And so I'd rather have kind of just a informal conversation like this with a coffee or a beer. And really what I want to hear at the beginning is I kind of want to, again, to be stereotypical and cliche, like I want to hear the why. I want to hear why the company started and then what's transpired from there to the conversation today. Ultimately, what I'm trying to get at with that why, I think, is what is this problem that you're trying to solve in the world? And we could get philosophical for a second. I think that is one of the issues with Shark Tank in and of itself. I love the show and actually don't really have that much negative to say about it, but it makes people think in terms of solutions. I just want to build the best solution, the million-dollar solution, people say, right? They should be saying billion-dollar solution probably, but the million-dollar solution. When in reality, when you start companies, and this applies to tech companies that are high growth, innovative companies, and it applies to the more Main Street type businesses, it's really what's that problem that you're solving for your customer. And so I think getting to that why and just having that informal conversation really starts to kind of inform that and help me understand that piece of the company and why it was started and then how we got to where we're at today. That's step one. From there, man, it's really, we're kind of looking again to almost piggyback on that last point, almost looking to hear what the market has to say. And what I mean by that is, have they been successful in going out and getting paying customers? Hopefully customers that aren't their dad or uncle or grandma, customers that they don't know actually paying them money. There's no better way to understand that a company has, let's call it market validation, or even just call it validation of the problem, than having someone that you don't know pay you money. And so to me, that's kind of, again, this creates this chicken or egg problem, I think, that we could talk a lot about, is like, well, if you just said that a company needs to go out and get revenue before they can get investment, the founder of the company might say back to me, what if I need investment to go get money? And so that does bring up an interesting point. Oftentimes there are sort of investors that come in at an earlier stage than we would. I think people have at least heard the name, but they're known as angel investors. So actually that's in theory what Mark Cuban and Mr. Wonderful and all those people actually are angel investors, which just means, this isn't the legal definition, but it might as well be, but it's just people that have a lot of money that are willing to invest in your idea, basically.
So would you say, to really strip it down, Invest Nebraska invests in companies and angel investors invest in ideas?
At its most basic level, yes, for sure. That's how it's kind of been. That's the conventional wisdom. Angel investors often are the ones that actually they'll get a bigger financial return because of that, because they're coming in at an earlier stage investing in this idea. And a lot of times what angels will tell you is they're not actually investing in the idea. They're investing in the founder. They're investing in that person. Everyone, again, being cliche, they say, bet on the jockey, right? Bet on the jockey, not the horse. Ideas don't necessarily matter. It's really execution that matters. But to simplify, yeah, it's totally betting at the idea stage versus we try to bet on companies that have a few more things figured out. Now, I will say as a caveat, and maybe this is taking it a step too far where people might not care, but I think people have seen this in the news and on Twitter and wherever, that there's a ton of money right now going into startup companies, specifically tech startup companies, and some that aren't tech-based. Like I think everyone's seen WeWork, which is sort of the co-working space that's a real estate company wrapped in a cloak that makes it feel like a high-growth startup. But what this crazy amount of money in the system has done is sort of actually pushed a lot of investors downstream or later stage, where people are taking less and less risks at the early stage because everyone's kind of telling these companies, prove it. What I was going to say is kind of as a second piece to, yes, there are angel investors out there, but something else that I think is in 2020 is better and at least encouraging for founders that are wondering how to get to that place where they have revenue without investment. It's way, way, way cheaper and easier to build a initial product. So people call that an MVP, which is minimally viable product or minimum viable product. It is way cheaper and easier today in 2020 to get to an MVP that you can actually go sell to someone than it ever has been. And so there's sort of this expectation that you're going to put a few dollars of your own in. Maybe you're going to drive Uber on the side and get your product into the market. And if you just come with an idea looking for investment, you could make the argument that that's somehow not as good.
Isn't that a bit of a mixed message for people who are trying to create a startup?
For sure. It's one that we have to think about all the time, because again, I talked at the beginning about these incubators, these accelerators, and even on the angel investors, we are trying at Invest Nebraska, or me personally, we're trying to improve and increase those things in the ecosystem. And those are really tools to help people get from the idea stage to the cash stage. And some of those are investments tied to those as well. Sometimes they're not always free. If you participate in a program, oftentimes you're taking money from the accelerator and giving up equity. And so it's weird because you want to add tools and infrastructure to help people, but then part of you is also saying, I want you to go figure it out on your own because that makes you seem cool and gritty and whatever else. And so it's totally everything in investing. It's all subjective. People don't want to admit that, but it's definitely mixed messaging for sure.
Well, one of the things that I always find interesting is there'll be a conversation about like, what problem are you trying to solve?
Yep.
And to me, the details and the nuance around that discussion start to have this downstream effect on everything else that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm trying to solve a complicated problem and my solution is, say, one where creating an MVP is not cheap, then to have you say it's cheaper than it ever has been, not really that helpful to me.
So it is, I think, important at this point to create a distinction, because that's a fantastic point. And I should have clarified this at the beginning. The vast majority of investment, both in Nebraska and throughout the United States and the world now that kind of startups and venture capital has really expanded global, and that's obviously been a longer term thing, not just super recently, but the vast majority of investment still goes to kind of these tech software startups that fit into that box, that cheap and easy to create that first MVP, because I'm creating this software product that it's easy to get out and get my first beta client, which means just a client that kind of tests the product, and they're willing to pay me for that. Now, I think the second most active in terms of investment category, maybe this is first, maybe I have it backwards, but I think number two is biotech or med tech, is as it's referred. But that could include things like medical devices. So that might be a company that's creating a new tool for a certain type of surgery in the OR, and it's going to take roughly 5 years and at least $5 million to even get to the place where you're legally able to sell your product into the market. So that's a totally different category where, of course, those companies aren't going to have revenue. So instead, as a trade-off for not having revenue, the expectation from investors is that these companies have hopefully intellectual property. So I think everyone's familiar with patents and things that kind of create that moat or that defensibility for the company. Something else is oftentimes in the biotech space, there's peer-reviewed journals. So now that we're kind of in the sports science world for this conversation, that's something I think most people are familiar with here. And then really it's kind of taking those things and hopefully going to get some grant money, because there are tons of grants available in that world to build out that MVP. And that's kind of the proof point, as opposed to looking for revenue like we might in a typical quote-unquote software startup. Now, there's also these companies that are in the in-between space, which is software / technology. They kind of come from that bucket, but they are definitely more advanced in terms of the CapEx or the capital expenditure required to get started. And that now we're talking about things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, some of the stuff that Eliteform does with the really high-tech cameras and hardware. Now, these are things that are definitely kind of in that middle ground where, again,
so would,
you might have to spend a couple $100,000 just to get a working prototype.
So would our sister company, Acuvera,
yep,
fit, shout out Steve King,
yep,
fit more of the model Steve's of awesome. That... that biotech space you were trying to describe?
Absolutely. Yeah, they would sort of be almost a mix between kind of that middle category that's using sort of, let's call it, I'm just going to be as cliche as possible through this whole thing, like deep tech is sort of how it's grouped in, that all that machine learning, artificial intelligence. It's sort of a blend of that and also sort of like the biotech world as well, where in their world, for a hospital to buy their product, they have to effectively do a pilot that's probably going to take 6 months, maybe a year, where they're actually analyzing patients. And then the hospital is going to look at the data. And because ultimately they make data-based decisions, like like many big companies and enterprise companies should. And so that's a totally different early stage cycle for a company, and they're ultimately going to have to invest way more money at the early stage to get to that point. Another, I think, point that's important to talk about is there are certain companies that by their very nature and because of who their client is, they can't just ship. So ship in this world just means like put an MVP out into the market. They can't ship an MVP that is an MVP, that is half-assed, and that is not great and has tons of bugs. That's the banking world. If I'm going to sell banking software, I can't walk into a bank and try to sell them an MVP. I'm not going to make very many sales. The same is true of Acuvera. Can't sell to a hospital if I have this product that barely does what we say it does. Finance, banking, medical. Honestly, I could argue in the kind of the sports science space as well, right? Like if I walk into a weight room, I can't say like, hey, someday my product is going to be able to do this for you. You kind of have to put it up there and show that it works. So I perhaps intentionally, perhaps as an oversight, totally simplified at the beginning there. But so there are definitely exceptions to that broad rule.
That's all right. People will figure it out.
Yeah.
The way you sort of wrap that kind of killed off the angle I was going to take. So I'm like, where do we want to go with this now? But so how is or is it? So obviously we're right in the middle of the COVID-19 epidemic.
Yep. I think am I your first COVID guest?
Yeah. Well, technically, I suppose so. But I unfortunately said right in the middle.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even actually could be the beginning. True. So since you brought up medical.
Yep.
Like, do you have a sense yet for how this may impact the investment world going forward?
Absolutely. Speaking of extremely loaded questions, I think there's a bunch of things we can talk about here. One.
Well, hopefully it wasn't loaded in the negative sense of that.
No, I don't think so. There's a lot of ripple effects. Like yeah, I think yeah, everyone's exactly. finding out about this COVID. It really sort of permeates everything from not just the health side, but also the economic side. So I think there's a couple different impacts to the investment world. The first is probably super simple, is startup companies in the venture capital world. And again, those are sort of these high, quote unquote, high growth, innovative tech companies that are used to raising money from outside investors and being incentivized to grow as fast as possible. Now, if you think about what that means, if a company is trying to grow as fast as possible, they're usually not focused on maximizing profit or minimizing expenses for that matter. So if I'm just trying to gain revenue and gain sales and new customers, I'm spending money on my product. I'm spending money on hiring. I'm spending money on having the coolest office.
Turning dollars you earn back into
growing. Yes. Trying to, turn each dollar into more dollars. I'm not concerned with running lean, keeping costs low, and maximizing the ultimate money cash that we're putting in the bank. So obviously that is a massive misalignment with how companies need to operate now in the era of COVID-19. So as an initial matter, the first impact is companies are now, they all know this, they're all incentivized now and encouraged and figuring out how to reprioritize cash, basically liquidity, and slow down growth and not necessarily worry about growing 200% plus year over year or whatever their metric that they're going for is. And so companies are, I think we're going to see companies just grow slower.
To back up a half step, yeah. When you talk about growth, so there's a few metrics people will use to define that. You want to talk a little bit about how you're thinking about that? Because we can talk about top line growth, right?
Yep.
Or you could grow your net and effectively have more cash. So
yes.
Maybe a little bit more detail.
Yeah. So ultimately in the investment world, and this, by the way, is, I think more people are familiar with the public markets, the stock market, right? Everyone understands, for the most part, retirement accounts, stocks, index funds, all of those things that most people are investing in to hopefully grow their wealth over time. The reason I bring that up is that is actually quite a bit different in terms of growth expectations than the startup world. So in the startup venture capital world, really, we're talking about top line revenue growth, meaning sales. How many dollars am I bringing in the business?
And you're separating that, just to make sure we're all being clear, from how much you're spending to generate that revenue.
Exactly. Most investors, obviously, I'm sort of intentionally like speaking in absolutes here, but most investors really don't care all that much about how much you're spending, right? In fact, if you raise $1 million, I expect you to spend it in 12 months effectively to try to grow fast, and then you can raise more money. So there's this weird dance that goes on where investors are almost expecting you to burn, as again, is kind of the cliche term, to burn money in service of this top line revenue growth. Now, why I created the distinction with the public markets is public markets, the stock market, rewards companies for growing profits over time, cash, and building more fundamentally strong businesses that theoretically at least can weather a economic downturn. Startups aren't necessarily built for that. So that's the biggest impact right off the bat.
But is that a conversation? So you're having a conversation with a founder. Is this conversation of what kind of company do you foresee becoming something that you're tackling early on? In other words, would you be saying to, you know, a founder of company XYZ, no, I don't think this is going to be successful if you start operating with cash in mind. You're going to be more successful both in gaining investment and, I suppose, you tell me, potentially as a company over time if you simply focus on generating top line revenue?
Yes. That is a conversation we have right away. And so this is a sidetrack that could go a little deeper into the venture capital philosophy.
We go wherever we need to go.
So redirect me if we get too far.
To burn the ships at the shore, we will.
For those that maybe aren't familiar, perhaps a brief context of how venture capital makes money is helpful here. In the venture capital world, and by the way, to be clear, this is one of the things that venture capital and the industry gets a lot of pushback and a lot of blowback for. And we can talk about the the ethical merits if we want, but
philosophy major. We can talk ethics all day.
I'm fine with that. The way a venture capital firm makes money is by what is known as a power curve model. So I think everybody's familiar with a bell curve, right? Sort of an equal distribution where the largest concentration of data points is sort of in between, let's say, 40 and whatever, 60, or concentrated around the middle, the 50%, the median. A power curve is where almost all of the concentration is at one end as a versus the other or versus the middle. The example of how that actually works out, which will be much easier to visualize than the way I just attempted to describe it, is if a venture capital firm invests in, let's say, 100 companies, the expectation, now this is weird, the expectation of the investor is that 60 or 70 of those are going to outright fail. Probably within 18 months, actually preferably within 18 months. Out of the remaining 30 or 40 that are left, 3/4 of those are going to be moderately successful and maybe sell someday and return the investor, let's say, 1 to 2 times their money. So if I invest $100,000, it might return $100,000 or maybe $200,000 back to me later. Then I hope that out of the fourth that's remaining, so depending on which number we use, the 7 to 10 companies that are left, five to seven of those are going to maybe return a 2 to 5x return. And two of those, 100, are going to return me 100x plus.
And can you just...
I can explain
to be helpful
why.
For folks. So just sort of the quick thought process when you say 2x, 3x, can you demarcate for people those two numbers? So in other words, you've invested, let's just say $1 million to
yep.
make it easy.
Yep.
Right? So 3x equates to what metric on the other side?
Yeah. So at its simplest level, if I invest $1 million in each of those 100 companies and I say I got a 2x investment or a 2x return on that money, that means I got 2 million back when that company sold. If I say 5x, I got 5 million back when I invested 1 million. Why those numbers matter is if you think about how, again, maybe some more context here, how a typical venture capital fund or firm operates is they raise money from outside investors. Sometimes those investors are angels like we talked about before. Sometimes they're foundations. Sometimes they're endowments. Sometimes they're state pensions. Any number of investors. They could be big institutional investors also, or family offices, which are basically just offices that manage extremely wealthy families' wealth. They are looking for a return that beats the stock market. Obviously, otherwise they would just invest in the stock market because it is less risk and more predictable over time. So in other words, if we look back on the last 20 years, or let's say like 18 years, so we can start in 02, you could say the stock market has returned whatever, 8 or 9% every year since then. So as a venture capital fund or firm, we have to beat that and now return, let's say 10 or 12 or 14% each year to our investors to make them happy. What that equates to when looking at a full fund. So when I say fund, I mean the full amount that a firm has to invest. So in our example earlier, we had, let's say it was a $100 million fund and we made $101 million investments. In order for me to give them that 12, 14, 16% return, I have to make on a $100 million fund, I have to return $300 million. So I have to return a 3X, if I use the same language I used before, to make my investors happy. If you do the math and you say, well, what if I just have a bunch of companies return a 5X, so return 5 million? Think about how many companies would have to do that for me to get to 300 million. I think, let's not do the math, right? Well, actually we can. So 60 out of, I was not confident on my quick math. 60 out of 100 companies would have to return a 5X and the rest could fail for me to be able to return what my investors expect. As we know, venture capital technology startups are very, very high risk. So there's effectively a 0% chance that we'll get 60 out of 100 to do that. So that's why that model doesn't work, where we say, well, what if every company just does well and doesn't turn into Uber? And so when you do the math that way, what you arrive at is that that's the only model that really works super well for what venture capitalists are looking for, is a bunch of companies fail, a handful of companies do reasonably well, and one or two companies turns into Uber and returns you 1,000x. And that's what gets them their return. So trying to bring this back around to sort of the original question, which was sort of when do you set that expectation or do you talk about the growth expectation? My answer is that's a conversation I have on day one. Because if a company isn't interested in that, if they don't want to try to sell their company for 10 times what it's worth today, then I literally cannot invest in them. And every venture capitalist would agree. So they have to have the expectation, but also the plan to grow relatively fast and want to grow a decent sized company that they sell in 5 to 10 years. That's the other piece of it.
They have to be willing to sell their company in 5 to 10 years. If they're not, that's great. By the way, that's totally valid. I should say that it's totally valid to run a company that you want to grow organically and you want to maximize and optimize profit and not just revenue. It's also totally valid to run a company you're passionate about that you don't want to sell in 5 to 10 years. It's just inappropriate for you to raise venture capital. That's the only way for an investor to get their money out, really, with few exception, is to sell your company. So that's a conversation I want to have on day one, on the first coffee, to just make sure we're on the same page. So to that end, I feel like a lot of my conversations are often talking people out of raising money because
Are you then diverting them to other resources? So, sure.
So absolutely. So to help again, provide context there, I think there's two main buckets of funding for companies. One is, let's just call it traditional financing. So in that bucket is all of the things that most people understand: bank loans, lines of credit, grants, organic funding, revenue funding, a check from grandma, whatever it might be, just kind of traditional funding that everyone sort of understands what the goals are and how to pay it back and things like that. The other bucket is sort of this, we can call it venture capital or we can call it high growth or whatever. And that's sort of this more esoteric, like weird funding that I would argue is inappropriate for 99.9% of companies out there, because it's not necessarily what most companies want to do to grow super fast and really just kind of at all costs raise more and more money so you can build a big business or one that sells for some crazy multiple for your investor. So I think the main takeaway for this, to try to put a little bit of a bow on it is super important from day one. And look, this is probably true of businesses with their customers as well, right? Or schools and their students. It is imperative from day one for your expectations and also your incentives to be aligned every step of the way. Mm-hmm. As soon as your incentives become misaligned, that's often when companies fail and when people get fired and bad things happen that you see on Twitter then. So for me, it's important to set that expectation, make sure the company has that same goal and strategy and whatever, and then we can carry on the investment conversation. So that was a long tangent, but perhaps an important one.
Well, I mean, casually speaking, right? I'm not sure watching Shark Tank really allows people to understand sort of the specifics around what venture capital means. Yep. In terms of the functioning of a business over time.
Yep.
So, you know, you'll see in the news that X company, I think Amazon, this was the case for a really long time, huge numbers that were being discussed, never any profit. Right. And so then people would wonder, well, Johnny and I had a conversation, John Coates, shout out. Yeah. We were, I think, on our way back from K-State, and he was like, hey, give me the rundown on venture capital. And I'm not saying I did the greatest job, but one of the things that is a compelling conversation becomes, there is a notion of sort of, you're always letting companies go.
Yeah.
Right? And so, at no point, I shouldn't maybe say at no point, but you can speak to this if you'd like. There's a certain set of expectations, which is there's a period of time that a venture firm is going to have an interest in that company. And it's to achieve the equation the way I like to look at it, right?
For sure.
So we hit 3X. There's an exit, right? And maybe we should define that for people. But there's a way in which that investor is made whole. And so, tell me if I'm wrong, I would imagine for a lot of folks, then they're sort of done thinking about that company.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess to be fair to investors, they're going to be the first ones that write you a check into your next company, right? So,
yeah, and I didn't mean that in a callous way.
Yeah.
They maybe still hope they do well.
Yeah, but ultimately, a fund's life cycle is 10 years in the typical method. That means my investors, my LPs as they're called, which just stands for limited partners, which is kind of the legal organization of a venture fund. My LPs want their money back in 10 years without exception. Like, that's in a contract. And so if I'm an investor and I see a company failing, like, it's just as well if they fail fast because I can stop worrying about them and move on to the company that might be Uber. Conversely, once a company exits, yeah, like, as long as I've got my return, now I'm sort of like focused on nurturing the other companies to try to get them to have a higher return. So I think that that's definitely correct. The flip side to what I just said, though, to just maybe provide like a counterpoint, is like, some of these companies, if you can survive long enough, then you can take advantage of certain things in the market, right? So I hate to like romanticize the COVID thing, but a good example is, I saw someone on Twitter, an investor that I follow, said this the other day. Everyone remembers that HQ trivia game that was super popular for a while, where everyone, you could get on this app and like play with people worldwide and you answer trivia questions and got points. I don't know. It was super popular and it was venture backed and they were making a bunch of money. They failed like a month ago. Think how popular that could be right now with everyone sitting at home trying to avoid talking to their spouse. So again, I don't want to make light of that situation, but the point is there are really compelling reasons why a company should try to exist for as long as possible, because oftentimes the opportunity in the market, which no one can control, comes when you least expect it. And I could probably make a more tasteful, better analogy about, you know, when technology is finally ready and finally adopted in society, a company that's in virtual reality 10 years ago was way too early and a lot of investors lost a lot of money on that. But if you started one 3 years ago and are still hanging around now, you perhaps take advantage of this new market that could pop up at any time. So I don't want it to sound like we want any of our companies to just fail. But
isn't a portion of your point, though, there's only so much of that an investor can consider.
For sure.
Because talk about something you're not going to be able to control.
Yeah, you only have so much bandwidth. And like, again, each investor might sit on the board of directors for 15 or 20 companies in a fund. And so like, part of being a good investor, I had a conversation with one of our portfolio companies this week via text about this. There's a difference between being an investor and being a good investor. Being an investor just means you are taking on a certain amount of risk with an expected return and giving someone money. Being a good investor means that you do that, but then in order to increase your expected return, maybe we go straight to the math, I also want to provide operational assistance and guidance. And I want to build up my network so that I can give access in my network to my company. And that could be a network for employees, for other investors, for clients. I want to provide business coaching. I want to provide mental health support. I just want to be there when they need someone to talk. Like, there are all these other things that make a good investor. And so my point in saying this, and there is one, is as an investor, you really do only have limited bandwidth to be a great investor in a certain number of companies. And so, yeah, like, there is a little bit of, once a company is kind of either looks like it's going to fail, or walking dead is a lot of times what investors would say, then you sort of have to shift your emotional capacity to someone else.
Is walking dead the company that's just making enough money? Or
yeah. The company that it's very clear their organic growth is not going to sustain them hiring people, making advances in their product, adding new clients. They're kind of just getting by, and maybe they're cash flow positive, but like, ultimately, like, they have no desire to grow at all, or just aren't in a position to do so. So yeah, I think it's just companies that like are going to fail at some point, and it's just a matter of when, and you stop hearing from those companies typically. And that's, yeah, I mean, you try your best to keep up with everyone, but I feel like there's a chance I'm painting investors in a poor light here, but we can see if I can salvage it.
I mean, from sitting across from you, I don't get the sense that that's okay. What's going on.
Good.
There's just a nuance that I think exists and an interesting conversation between what you see on Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Right. And then you can almost argue the mathematical structure, right, around how investment at that level works.
Yeah. Right. And to be fair, and maybe this gives a little credit back to the investor, like, it is all a math game. Like I said before, the math just doesn't work to say, I want a bunch of our companies to just do okay. The math only works in the power curve model, where one or two companies turn into Uber or insert other successful company here. Now, that's only for this venture capital bucket, right? There are lots of other types of investment that are perfectly valid and are attractive for companies and are attractive for investors that don't follow that model. So I don't want it to sound like venture capital is the only model that works, because that's definitely not the case. But I guess in defense of investors, like, that's the model that works, and that's why they do that for a reason. It's not because they want to only have Ubers.
Well, I could be wrong, but one of the challenges, I think, in talking about venture capital right now is it's turned into a bit of a buzzword.
Yes.
And there's sort of a, when you talk about the startup community, that has become a bit more of a cliche. And people think of, you know, everyone around laptops and coffee shops.
Yep.
Doing business, and sort of the facts of the matter have gotten lost.
Yeah.
In that sort of narrative.
I have two good examples that prove why you're not wrong in saying that. The first is how it's sort of been bastardized in a way that now every region in the United States calls themselves some version of Silicon Valley, right?
Sure.
Like
the Silicon Prairie.
Yeah, we call ourselves the Silicon Prairie. There's a Silicon Hills up north. There's Silicon, like, literally every region in the country does that. You have to embrace it, it's a joke, but you sort of have to embrace it. But that's one example. The other example is, to your point about how venture capital has become this kind of like buzzword that people maybe don't fully understand. Part of it is just because of the extreme like proliferation of venture capital over the last 10 years. What I mean is, if you look, and I don't have the exact numbers, so I probably shouldn't say any of them at all, but if you look at like 2009, 2010, 10 years ago,
we'll just imagine you putting air quotes around that.
Well,
it'll be good.
I just assume that no one's going to fact check me. That's kind of how I operate my life. So 10 years ago, 2009, 2010, there was like something like 100 venture capital funds that were over $50 million or something, which I know sounds like a lot, but that's actually a small fund. As of like 2019, there were like 750. So within the last 10 years, the venture capital industry has seen the most growth it's ever seen in terms of dollars and funds. So it's become more of this mainstream thing where people see it and it looks sexy and whatever. And so that's also contributed to the like buzziness of it. And honestly, I think over the next couple of years, we'll see that correct, just like we do in a lot of industries. I think we'll see the number of firms go down. We'll see consolidation. The ones that are shitty will close. And the ones that do great have probably done great for the last three decades. And again, I don't want to go down too far in this rabbit hole, but almost all venture capital returns. So the venture capital funds that make money come from 2% of venture capital funds. In other words, 15 funds out of 700 make all the money. The rest don't make money. That's a bad stat for venture capitalists. But again, they operate on a 10-year cycle. So every time they raise a fund, they buy themselves 10 years no matter what happens. So I think, like I said, the cycle we're talking about now is the last 10 years, there's been a lot of growth. A lot of those funds aren't going to be able to raise their next fund.
So how would a fund... I'm having fun with this.
Okay.
How would a fund that's been successful actually prove that they knew what they were doing, as opposed to just getting lucky?
They don't have to, right? Like, as an LP, you don't care.
Well, if you're sitting on that success,
yeah,
certainly that's true. But say you entertain the argument.
Yeah, I'll entertain the... I'm going to say one thing, then I'll entertain the argument. To that point, what you often see is a fund that raises their first fund and ends up being successful. They raise their next fund, and usually fund two is a dip in terms of return. Almost always when you look at the data. That's part of the reason is they just got lucky, right? Like I said, you only need one Uber in a fund, and all of a sudden you do amazing. But if you don't hit that Uber, if you miss it or it doesn't happen, you don't. So that's interesting. Another nuance that most people don't know about that I think is important here is you raise funds every 3 or 4 years. So you raise your next fund before your first one, before you even know how it did. So to your question, I have to entertain because of what I just said, right? Like, you still have to try to show and prove that you knew what you were doing in order to raise your next fund. And you might not have the data to back it up either. So really what you do,
everyone likes an optimistic forecast.
So yeah. So what you do is you, as you just alluded, you pick the portfolio companies that you invested in that are doing well. And that's definitely in air quotes, right? Because what does doing well mean? We already talked about it. It means you've grown top line revenue and maybe you've raised another round of capital. That's the ultimate sign of a company doing great.
Well, would it be doing well, to back up something we were talking about earlier, would it be doing well under the context with which you got investment?
For sure.
In other words, like you discussed the fact that there's some different approaches you could take, and you're going to talk about that up front, right? So if you had said to Elite Form, you know, I expect 5x growth in year one, whether or not that happened or not, that was the expectation that was
set. Yeah, right. So you can use those measurements or those goals to then go back to your LPs and say, hey, this is what we thought this company could do. They hit their milestones, hit their goals, hit their KPIs or their key performance indicators or whatever they've set out.
Should also tell people what an LP is.
We can circle back to that. They've hit their milestones and their goals, and now they raised another round of funding, and now their revenue, instead of $1 million a year, is $5 million a year. And so that means that we knew what we were doing when we made our first investment. That's literally as simple as the argument is. And theoretically, at least, if they liked you enough to put money in your first fund, and you're able to show a couple of those examples, again, maybe they don't care if you got lucky. Most of the time, they're going to put more money in. Like I said, though, I think we're going to see a lot of these first and second time funds that are going to fall off because LPs, which we can talk about, are going to realize that maybe they're not going to get the returns they hope for.
Well, wouldn't some of that also potentially circle back to your definition of a good investor?
For sure. For sure. A large part about maybe what that sell is, especially today with how many investors there is a bigger emphasis than ever on trying to show the value you provide as an investor. So again, talking about the discussion on Twitter and in the public these days, there's always these arguments about how to be helpful and provide value to companies.
And that exists even in a world where people are coming to you?
It doesn't exist in my world. So now a little differentiation between. It can, right? And because I still endeavor to be a good investor.
Well, sure.
But it exists.
But you're
much
not
less.
Having to sell yourself.
Yeah, because I'm the only option in Nebraska, more or less, right? There's 3 or 4 or 5 options. But like, if you raise money in Nebraska, like as long as you don't want to go out of state, you have a finite amount of options. And so, yeah, I've never lost and never will probably, at least in the short term. Yeah. Knock on wood. But like, I'm not competing with other people for deals. In fact, I'm trying to get them to join in on the deal to raise the amount that the company wants to raise. There's never been a situation where I was afraid I was going to miss out because someone else was going to be more valuable or invest before me.
And for context for people, how is that different from
Let's just say out west. So as I mentioned at the very top, venture capital funding goes to something like 88% of venture capital funding goes to 3 cities or 3 regions. But it's really Silicon Valley, New York, and Boston. So let's just focus on Silicon Valley. Out of those 750 funds, something like, again, I don't have the data here, but something like 500 of those are probably in Silicon Valley. So that means that if there's 100 good deals a year in Silicon Valley, you have 500 investors trying to compete for those 100 deals. So that is very much an outbound sales process, and it's very much me trying to show my value as a quote-unquote good investor by saying, here's my expertise, here's how I can coach you, here's who I can introduce you to, here's my relationship with the investors that you're going to need to go to for the next round or the next time you raise funding. And so it's all a competition to show that. So I think to your underlying point, those are some of the same things you're going to want to show or advertise to your potential LPs or the people investing in your fund, is by saying, I sold two software companies for $1 billion. So that means I'm especially equipped to pick the next $1 billion software company. So it's a lot of trying to prove your value, I think.
So do you personally have any interest in going to one of those three markets and deeply experiencing this other world?
In a vacuum, in a different life, for sure. Like my ambition, my innate ambition requires that, right? Where I would definitely want to go to one of the big markets and be a small fish in a big pond and try to outkick my coverage and like learn and grow and get better, just like most people in their respective professions often do. In real life, I don't have that aspiration. Me and my wife plan to stay in Nebraska for conceivably forever and love Nebraska, and so have no real designs in doing that. But sure, I'm super intrigued by how, and it would be a hell of a lot harder. I've talked to my predecessors at Invest Nebraska who have all moved into bigger markets, and almost without exception, they have lamented and said, man, I miss being a big fish in a small pond. And they don't mean that arrogantly or like in a cocky way, but it's like, it was a lot easier when people came to me. Like now I have to seek out and compete with others. But of course, like there's a part of me that I think that would fuel me. Again, just like anyone that wants to be kind of at the top of their field, I think, but I don't think it is in the plan. So well, anything could happen.
Sure. Life has its own design sometimes. There's no question about that. So how would you feel about sharing some Malort, trying some Malort?
I would love to try some Malort. I'm a little anxious. I went a little too deep on the Wikipedia page, and I think it, I wish I wouldn't have. I wish I would have just came in blind.
Well, at least you didn't go onto YouTube.
True.
That can offer its own level of insight that might have kept you from doing this.
Well, so I heard you on a previous episode talk about what's on the back of the bottle in terms of the description, but the Wikipedia page talks about...
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Cheers. It talks about the previous description that used to be on the back of the bottle that was way more aggressive than the current one. So
you want to enlighten folks on what that was? Oh, he's got it. Ooh. So what's happening since we're on radio?
Okay.
He's pulling it up on his phone.
Pulling up on my phone. I did make...
Clearly has it
not
bookmarked.
Not a great face when I took the first sip of the Malort.
Speaking of Malort, while you're pulling that up, shout out to Jepson's Malort because they are now making hand sanitizer.
Oh, okay.
Making hand sanitizer.
Have you attempted to get them to be a sponsor?
So Kyle Dermier fronts a lot of that for us, and we put that goal in front of him. He's not had any success yet.
Okay.
So we're going to give him some more time to get that done, and then if it doesn't happen, I may have to directly reach out myself.
Yeah, so I've seen a bunch of distilleries and or alcohol producers have started to take their alcohol to make hand sanitizer. I've heard one of the issues, and yeah, shout out to everyone that's doing that. That's great. And also like seeing Ford and Tesla and some of these other companies that are starting to build ventilators and stuff is super cool as well. So anyway, shout out to all of them. But I've heard that in order to make hand sanitizer, you have to like add I don't know if it's like glycerin or what, but some special ingredient to the alcohol. And apparently no one can find it. So all these companies that are trying to make hand sanitizer are having a really hard time to do it. Now we're way off track. Okay. This might be filed away in bad podcasting.
Well, one more note on the hand sanitizer before you get into that. They branded it appropriately. And the tagline was two-fisted clean. which I think you just have to.
I like that.
So,
you do.
So please.
So the current label on the back says basically full-bodied flavor, bitter taste savored by two-fisted drinkers. The old label said, it was much more aggressive, said most first-time drinkers of Malort reject our liquor. It is strong, sharp taste is not for everyone. It is rugged, unrelenting, and even brutal to the palate. During almost the 60 years of American distribution, we found that only one out of 49 men will drink Malort. During the lifetime of our founder, Carl Jepsen was apt to say, "My Malort is produced for that unique group of drinkers who disdain light flavor or neutral spirits. It is not possible to forget our two-fisted liquor." And it actually goes on, but I found that to be interesting, and it did make me anxious, but it's not bad. I don't know if I'm going to get it with water next time I'm at the bar, but.
Well, you'll have a hard time finding it because it's only available in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
That's another nuance. Now, I say that we have, because we travel a lot, we always keep an eye out, and we have seen random bottles. So I think the last time we saw a random bottle was in Indianapolis. So still potentially achievable. And there's always, you can always drop by the Elite Form office since you're only a couple of blocks away.
I'm sure you order cases of it, or do you?
Well, we don't order cases of it.
You only get it when you travel?
We get it when we travel, exactly. So now that it's just become more and more of an Elite Form thing, right, if you will. Yeah, so, you know, one of the concerns and the risks with the pandemic now is running out. We're not supposed to be traveling anywhere. Right?
That is a big concern. They might make an exception. If they sponsor the podcast, I imagine they could make an exception. Send you some free.
It seems like a complicated set of circumstances to work through, but fair enough.
With that attitude, for sure.
Well said. Well said.
I appreciate it.
So, what else would people be surprised to learn about investment?
Ooh, this is a good one, and it's a tad self-sabotaging, and that's why I like it. Maybe this will make sense based on some of the things I've said previously, particularly about how most venture returns come from a small number of funds or firms. If you look at the data, and I understand that most of the people that listen to this probably are concerned with data and looking at those things. If you look at the data about venture capital returns, what you find is nobody is really good at picking companies. Again, it really goes back to simple math, and it boils down, and when I say it, I mean achieving the desired return that you want, really boils down to a numbers game. In other words, if you want to achieve traditional or expected venture capital returns, you ought to invest in 100 companies instead of 10 carefully picked companies, because the odds that one out of those 100 is going to be the next Uber is far greater than if I picked 10 and wanted one of those to be the next Uber. People have actually done, there have been several studies at different universities and different angel groups and things. The Kauffman Foundation, which is a big multi-billion dollar foundation based out of Kansas City that does a ton of stuff with entrepreneurship and small business, they've done some analyses, and they did a Monte Carlo analysis, which is effectively just analyzing data points on venture capital returns of a huge data set of different groups from like a 10 or 12 year period, and basically said, if you invest in 15 companies, the odds that you're going to get just your money back is like 80% or something. Once you invest in 30 companies, the odds that you get your money back is almost 100%, and the odds that you're going to get that 2 or 3x return on your money is way higher. As you approach 100 companies, the odds that you're going to get a 3x return goes way, way, way up. So, in other words, I think what would surprise people is stereotypically, investors act like they know things. They act like they know a lot of things, and they act like that they would be better than you or I sitting down and picking companies, when in fact the data would suggest that that is simply not true. So I think it would surprise people to know that as long as you can apply, I guess, intelligent filters and kind of get, much like you would in a business, right? Get kind of qualified leads and qualified options. From there, it's a numbers game. And if you want the highest chance of returns, you should invest in as many companies as possible. That seems to me, that's counterintuitive, I think.
And is that based on is there a minimum investment that comes along with that? Like you have to invest $500,000, like
not
is
necessarily,
there an applied
right?
size?
Not necessarily. So now this would certainly be getting in the weeds. Some venture capital funds have requirements in their thesis that say we need to get 10% ownership in the company or 20% ownership. The main reason for that is when you invest and you have a material percentage of the company, so say 10 or 20%, mm-hmm. you often have special rights where you have the ability to keep investing in that company and maintain that equity stake. Now, conversely,
sort of first right of refusal.
Exactly. It's basically a pro rata participation right, but I get the right to participate at my exact ownership so I can maintain that forever. So these people are usually defined as major investors, not to get in the legal side of things. But conversely, an angel investor that might put $25,000 in often isn't going to get those rights. They might end up with 0.5% of the company. And then if that company goes on to raise more money, they're going to get diluted to the point where their ownership is going to effectively go to zero. Now, it will never go to zero, right? But it will effectively go to zero. And so you don't have the ability to maintain your stake, basically. So there's this, I guess, minimum presumption that you at least have the ability to invest again if you want. But I think the people that ran those experiments were looking at angel investments all the way through like seed or investments that us as an institution would make, is known as seed investments. And I don't think they discriminate on that at all. I would argue, though, your chances go up if you're able to maintain your equity stake in a company. That said, for angel investors in particular, the conventional wisdom is if you invest at the beginning and get 5%, by the time the company exits, you'll probably have half of that. That's sort of the conventional wisdom, the way to think about it. So if you sell for $100 million, I'm not going to have 5% at the end because they've probably raised more money. I'll probably have 2.5% or something like that. So you have to think about your expected returns as an investor in that lens, knowing that I'm going to probably be diluted. Does that make sense? What dilution?
Makes sense to me.
Okay. Dilution literally just means your ownership in the company is going to be watered down over time by other investors and new money coming in. And if you can't keep investing, you're going to own less of the company. So I think everyone understands that, but...
And just for clarity, so that's often on a percentage basis.
Yep.
Right. And so there's a game that gets played of, well, yeah, I may go from a 5% ownership to a 2.5, but really, numerically speaking, if the company's making...
Yeah, your stake goes
20x,
up.
20x.
Yeah.
The dollars in the door for me obviously increase. So
yeah, that's why, maybe this is your point, but that's why as an early investor, I shouldn't be upset that the company wants to go raise more money. I should be happy because that theoretically is raising the expected value of their eventual exit, right? So yeah, I would rather have 2.5% of a big pie than 5% of a smaller pie, to be, again, cliche.
So on the other end of that, I've been in sort of bar conversations about this and never really have the greatest answer. When does the, from a company standpoint, when does the game end? And so here's, I've heard this phrased in many different ways, so bear with me here as I try to kind of tease it out. So there's initial investment,
yep.
Right? And so then maybe I have Ben and Invest Nebraska come in, round two, right? We grow, and now there's a desired exit from all the investors there. So now you've got to find somebody who wants to buy that company. And surely there's an expectation that there's going to be growth and profit from that potential buyer. And so there's all these steps along the way, right, of investment and then the equation that leads to some sort of net gain.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So that can't be an infinite process.
Yeah, right.
So talk a little bit about how you see, I don't know if it's the necessarily the end of that process, but sort of the end result.
Yes. So there are, for all intents and purposes, there are two exit possibilities for companies, ignoring failing. One is
which is the main
expected return. Historically, the gold standard, what everyone was trying to do and what most companies did, was IPO, which stands for initial public offering, which means my private company is now going and turning into a publicly traded company, which is considered an exit for the founders, for the employees, and for the investors, because now the shares are liquid, like we talked about before. So I can now take my 5% that I own and sell it on the public market to someone else, and I can get out if I want and take cash. So that's why it's considered an exit. You don't, when it goes public, you don't just lose your shares and get cash. You have to hold on to them and sell them like a normal person trading on the public stock exchange would. That is the traditional way to exit, was, I guess, is the better word. Now, very few companies IPO at all. The main reason for that, there are several, but the main reason is, like we talked about before, there is so much more money in the private market now. Companies don't need to exit to get those big amounts of cash that they were looking for. They don't need to IPO like they once did in order to get that either liquidity, that exit, or that cash to help their company grow. So now, by far, the most common type of exit is an acquisition. M&A just stands for mergers and acquisitions, but an acquisition meaning a bigger company that's either private or publicly traded, it doesn't matter, comes in and buys your company. So now to take a step back and actually try to answer your question, on the IPO scenario, actually on both scenarios, as a founder or a CEO or a manager or a key personnel of the company, regardless of IPO or acquisition, there's an expectation, not just an expectation, it will be a legal obligation that you stay on and work at the company for a period of time. Often these key employees will sign employment agreements. Usually it's a minimum of 2 years. It's usually 2 to 3. They often don't keep people longer than 3 years in terms of actual legal obligations. It's certainly possible that you could decide to stay for longer than 3 years, but that is usually the process because they want, again, to your point, they want you to stay on to establish or continue the continuity of the growth in the company and the employees and help that company grow in its new environment. And then ultimately they'll either keep you on or replace you. And so that would be the end of the road then for the founder. The investors got out previously, theoretically. Oftentimes in the acquisition space, this is a little in the weeds, but oftentimes the purchase price, a small percentage of that will get tied up in the employment agreements, meaning, let's say I want to buy your company for $20 million. $4 or $5 million of that might be contingent on you staying on and hitting certain goals. And so as an investor, I'm concerned about that because I own 5 or 10 or 15 or whatever the case might be of that $4 or $5 million that's being held back in escrow.
So people will tend to think about that on the at an employee level.
Yeah.
But that can also actually reach the investor level as well.
For sure. For sure. They can basically hold it all back in escrow. And if, as an investor, you are just taking your percentage, this definitely gets in the weeds. You often have a choice of whether you can just get your money back or if you want to take your percentage. So just for an easy, quick example, if I invested $1 million and the company was going to sell for $10 million and I own 20% of the company, I would rather take my percentage, meaning 20% of 10 million, which is 2 million, than I would just get my money back, my original million. But if the company only sold for $4 million, then I would want to take my million instead of my 20%. That's, again, getting into legal stuff, but most of the time as an investor, you have that choice. So if you're taking your percentage ownership, which most of the time you do in an acquisition, then I'm concerned about that money that's being held back. And so obviously there's nothing you can do about it, but I want you to hit your milestones and stay on and not rock the boat so I can get my full return. What most logical investors would do is just write that money off in their head. And instead of calling it a $20 million acquisition, they'd call it a $16 million acquisition. And if they get another check in the mail in 18 months,
that's interesting.
You throw a party. So that's kind of the exit stage. And that's both in the IPO scenario and the M&A scenario where the company key employees are expected to sort of stay on.
No, I think that's very interesting. You know, you mentioned there's been a shift, right, where most companies IPO'd at a certain point. When did that shift take place? When did you start seeing more companies go the M&A route as opposed to going for an IPO?
So really, it's been in the last 5 or 6 years. It's really been sort of in parallel with the increase in money in the private market like we talked about. Like we said, the last 10 years, the venture capital space has really exploded. That has sort of gone in parallel with this new trend or this switch to acquisition. So if you look at the last like 3 or 4 years, it keeps trending even more and more that direction, where you used to have companies that would IPO even in the dot-com boom era, which was effectively 1999 to 01, you would have companies that would IPO when they had $100 million of value or market cap or way, way lower numbers. And now you don't see companies IPO unless they're worth over $1 billion for sure. So there's just this, it's, I think, truly a result of just having so much money in the private space that it's easier to just go raise $100 million than it is to go through the hassle of IPOing. But now, going back to your previous question, you talked about how each time something happens, there's now this new expectation of growth. If you raise $100 million and your company's worth, in theory, let's say it's worth $300 million, guess what? Those investors, they still want a 5 to 10x return minimum. So now if you raise money at that point, you can't sell your company in 2 months for $500 million. Those investors won't allow it. They'll block it. They want you to now sell for a $4 billion. So you have to, every step of the way, when you decide to take on more money or whatever, you have to, again, go back to our early conversation about, I want to make sure my incentives are aligned with my investors. And if I'm trying to sell my company soon, I shouldn't probably take on more capital because they will be misaligned. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
Backing up kind of a half step to that sort of barroom conversation of when does it end?
Yep.
Right. So does the market tend to look at something that would be synonymous to a final exit, where now we're moving away from this idea of constant growth to more of a profitability conversation, or does the market tend to not work that way?
I think generally the market tends to not work that way, except in the IPO scenario where your new investors...
Now it's all about shares.
Yeah, right? Your new investors are now... Your share price is based on the growth of your profit over time, quarter to quarter, generally. And so now that game has completely changed. So I think even most people listening to this have seen in the news, Uber got a lot of blowback because they were very unprofitable for a long time. by the way, intentionally. And they got a lot of blowback when they entered the public market because people were saying, how are they going to survive? They're not profitable. Their share price is going to suffer. And the Uber CEO basically said, look, all we have to do is add 50 cents a ride and we're wildly profitable. So like we can do that at any point.
So shut up, everybody.
And so they did. And now if you saw last week, Uber just came out and said, by the way, we have, I think they said, $10 billion in cash in the company. And so they're like, we're not going anywhere. We can weather this storm. And their stock price shot up. So like, yes, that's when it starts to, the game changes and you start to focus on profitability. You could also make the same argument. I guess maybe I spoke too soon. You could probably make the same argument in an acquisition scenario. If I'm a big corporate company, I'm going to want you to be profitable and pay for yourself. And I care much less now about top line revenue growth. I care more about building this business unit or whatever it is and to be a profitable business unit. So maybe right at acquisition is where that starts to shift. But it doesn't shift when you're analyzing an acquisition. People that are acquiring companies don't look at high growth startups and say, you're not profitable, I'm not going to acquire you. They understand the game to the extent that they don't, I guess, worry about that. They probably look at, do they have the ability to shift and become profitable? Is there a line of sight to doing that? I'm sure they look at that. But acquisition, I think, is that point. I don't know. I haven't taken a company from investment to acquisition yet. So we've had several exit, but I haven't been.
So what have been, and if you can't talk about this, whatever, but what have been your successful, the companies that you worked with that have had successful exits, like what was that experience like?
It's obviously awesome. We've had, gosh, in 2019, I think we had three exits, have had one in 2020 already. They are, and that's not like a pat on the back. Like I don't get any commission for that, but it's really, really cool to see these entrepreneurs and these founders that have worked super freaking hard for a number of years, like get that point where they're like they get their payday to some extent. There was a company we had in December that exited to Siemens. So huge multinational, that's not even the right word, international global company that acquired them. And like, it was a good cash acquisition. And the funny thing is most acquisitions aren't broadcast what the actual purchase price was, but it was a super high profile, cool acquisition by a very household name, I guess. We had another one last year that was acquired by a publicly traded company down in Atlanta. And that company was in a much further along space. They had raised tens of millions of dollars, had a ton of institutional investors. And frankly, I don't even know if the CEO was the founder of the company or not, or if he was brought in later on. So it's crazy to go through and watch. Acquisitions, as you might imagine, take 6 months on the minimum and go further than that. And so one of the things we not struggle with, but make sure that we work hard at, is making sure that we help almost insulate our companies from acquisition talks, because most of them are not fruitful or a good use of the CEO or the entrepreneur's time. Most of the time, companies are just probing, trying to learn something or figure out, look at financials or whatever. And so many of our companies have learned the hard way that they would take a step back from the business, spend 3 months on an acquisition that in hindsight was never going to happen, even though they made it feel like it was going to. And then they realize, holy shit, we just put our business on hold for 3 months. We're not doing that again. So as investors that now have 60 or so active portfolio companies, and we have seen this
sure
tens of times, we can say, hey, let's appoint someone else as a middleman. Maybe it's Bart, or maybe it's an employee, to kind of be the point person and send them basic stuff that they need. But like, until this gets to the 5-yard line, at least, we're not going to dedicate real time to it, because you often regret it.
So. Well, my experience has been, even before that, like I've naively fielded some calls.
Oh yeah.
Like about investment, et cetera. And you'll spend you know, a half hour kind of covering the basics of the business, not really realizing that it's just a probe.
Right.
Right. There's not a lot of legitimate interest. And maybe that's not the best way to put it, but it's really not going to go anywhere.
Right.
But until, at least for me, until I'd fielded a few of those and saw the pattern.
Well, and it's hard to know because you, and this is true of all of us, right? In anything, like you sort of, in some cases, hear what you want to hear. It's the same with raising money. It's the same with whatever. And so like, if you're excited about an exit, like that's kind of probably what you're going to hear. And that's not anyone's fault. But yeah, you have to be diligent about like what to focus your time on.
But I'm sure if you're calling in, you're aware of that.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
There's a psychological game to,
Totally.
Absolutely.
So that's, yeah, it's an interesting process. We've been investing actively since basically January 1st, 2012. And so, like I said, if you think about a venture capital fund's life cycle, it's about 10 years. Ours is much different because we get new money every single year. So we don't have the typical model, but the point is we're in year 8 effectively. And so we're at the point where we're starting to see a bunch of these exits happen, which are super, super cool for Nebraska and the broader region for numerous reasons, right? One is like the wealth trickle down effect or waterfall effect that goes to employees, founders, investors, whatever, that hopefully turn around and reinvest. But another is, one of the things that I think is imperative to encourage younger people to think that being an entrepreneur is a legitimate career path is them logging onto Twitter or whatever the next version of Twitter is going to be and see that a company in their backyard
you should invest in
just
that,
sold
by the way.
For, yeah, I'd love to, just sold for $100 million and they go, oh shit, this is a legit valid career path. Maybe I should think about that instead of.
So how do you define entrepreneur? Right. So you just described it like it's a job description.
Yep.
And it's another one of those buzzword bingo sort of words right now. So how do you think about that term?
So this is something I've actually thought more about than probably most people because, and maybe this is a good segue, because I own a small business on the side that I would categorize as more of a main street business, meaning one that's going to grow slow and we're probably never going to sell it.
Which is?
And so I own a gym in Omaha, Nebraska, and it was a CrossFit gym. We've branded away from that, but that is the at least theory or methodology that
it's been nice for me because I didn't have to explain what the Olympic lifts were to you.
Yeah, so. Not at all. Yeah, nice. Right. And we can get into the weeds on the, I'm happy to talk shit about CrossFit. I'm good at that.
It's a brand.
But anyway, so the reason I've thought about it is for a while, and like this didn't keep me up at night, right? But I was like, I don't think I'm an entrepreneur, right? Because I basically took someone else's model that they'd already done and just like reappropriated it. So CrossFit, much like Orange Theory and Barry's Bootcamp and F45 and all these others, is sort of the same concept as a franchise, right? You're borrowing the name, you're borrowing some other things, and like CrossFit's a little different where, as opposed to Orange Theory and others, that you can kind of do it your own way for sure. But still, like, I felt like it wasn't super entrepreneurial. So I think historically I've defined entrepreneur as someone that solves a problem in an innovative way that hasn't been done before. But maybe that's too niche and maybe that's ruling out too many people that are running those main street businesses that are still taking on tons of risk, problem solving, having grit, doing all those things and showing those attributes that we talk about in entrepreneurship that maybe wouldn't fall into that category of like doing something in an innovative proprietary way. So I don't know if that's fair. I think I've always said someone that solves a problem in a new innovative proprietary way, but maybe it's just a business owner that.
So for you, does that term denote running a singular business and then a serial entrepreneur is someone who has run multiple businesses or how do you think about that?
I think on its face, yes. I think an entrepreneur can be someone that's done it one time. And oftentimes people say serial entrepreneur is someone that's done it multiple times. Now, to take it a step further, most entrepreneurs it's just something innate in them. They can't just do it once. Oftentimes you'll find that a real entrepreneur does it a bunch of times. Now, the exception might be the one that runs their business for their entire life, never sells it, grows it, whatever, and I would still consider them to be an entrepreneur.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong or if you feel differently.
Sure.
I don't know if it's possibly wrong about this, but it seems to me that the concept of entrepreneurship has started to match the cycle that you see in terms of venture capital.
Yep.
Where there's this sense of, I've built a business to the point where it's exited. Now that it's exited, unless there's some strings, right? I'm going to use that. It's like Tom Haverford at Parks and Rec.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to use that and right. I'm going to go back. And now I'm going to create another business, use what I've learned previously. And that becomes a narrative that gets told to VC.
Yep.
Right? Now the cycle starts all over again. But now instead of talking about it from the dollars coming in perspective, you're talking about this boots on the ground individual who knows how to build companies for you.
Yep.
The investment firm.
Yep.
Is that fair?
Totally. I think there's two parts to that. The first is almost without exception, at least that I can think of. I'm sure there's always an exception.
There's always an outlier.
Most entrepreneurs that sell their company and successfully exit aren't the type of people that are going to retire to a desert island, or not a desert island, a tropical island, right? Like, they are not the type that are built for that. They would do that, and after 2 weeks, they would be bored and want to build something else. Yeah. And so maybe that's one important piece, is like, just by their nature, they have to build the next thing. And now that they have the means, they can build whatever the hell they want instead of what they built before, which was maybe specifically to solve a problem that they could go get revenue for so they could get money, right? So it gives you the optionality to do whatever the hell you want. But maybe to your point, you're 100% correct. And this is prevalent and not disparaging in any way, but this is prevalent in Silicon Valley and on the coast, is like, it is very clear that that founders and entrepreneurs that have quote unquote either pedigree or are repeat founders get the vast majority of the money. So if I exit my first company, it is extremely easy for me to either go back to all my same investors or new investors and say, hey, you're not good at picking companies. I've already proved that I built one. So the chance that I'm going to do it again is just simply higher than the guy or gal that's doing it for the first time. And so it's super easy to raise money. And then to your point, it's just enriches the same people over and over again. Now, what you hope is along the way that all their employees had employee stock options and whatever, and there is a real trickle down of wealth that then allows those employees to either start their own company, be an investor, or whatever. But that is totally a 100% accurate perspective of kind of how it works and what the expectation is. When we have a founder exit, my first question is, okay, what's next? Like, I'm ready to invest. And maybe that's the most logical way to look at it. I don't know.
How long have you been doing this?
I've only been doing this for 2.5 years. So
you'll still be waiting to see some of those things
totally,
unfold, right?
Totally. We had in 2019, we had a company that I made the first investment in February of 2018 exited. Now look, it wasn't $100 million exit or IPO. They got acquired by a company that was a little bigger, but now we own stock in that other company and there's still a huge opportunity. So I've seen a few through my life cycle where I made the first investment and saw the exit. But yeah, the beautiful thing, again, this is a little self-deprecating. A wise person once told me that the best job to have is to be a corporate attorney, because you only have to be right 50% of the time and you'll never get fired. To take that a step further, I found that the best job, for a number of reasons, to be a venture capitalist, because it's a 10-year feedback loop. So
you'll have gray hair.
My next job before they know if I did a good job on my first job. So yeah, to your point, we'll see if I'm good at this or not. To be determined.
I'm not sure that was my point, but fair enough. Fair enough.
It was a hint. It was a hint in there, I think.
Ah, don't be so skeptical. So we've been talking for an hour 43.
Wow.
And that's only what's recorded. It's not even counting the rest of that. So should we wrap up, do you think?
Yeah, we can, unless you have anything.
Well, we can always do another session.
My wife gave me a thumbs up, which, yeah, we could do a part two. My wife gave me a thumbs up, which could be a real thumbs up or it could be a snarky thumbs up, but
I don't have any experience to add anything.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
no, we'll just close out for now.
Okay. When we get raving reviews, we'll do a part two.
Thank you very much for listening to the Elite Forum podcast. Thanks to Ben for coming on. As you can tell, he's got a little juice. And of course, most importantly, hope everyone stays safe and healthy. Do what we can do to flatten the curve, and let's get back to as much of a normal as we can as soon as possible. Thanks, everybody.